This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Springfield Confidential, jokes, secrets, and outright lies from a lifetime writing for The Simpsons by Mike Reese with Matthew Klickstein. This is Mike Reese. To Matt Groening, Jim Brooks, and Al Jean, thanks for the greatest job in the world. Don't fire me. Welcome to the humiliating world of professional writing. Homer Simpson. Foreword by Judd Apatow. In the early 90s, I was a comedian and an aspiring writer. I made my living in three ways. During the day, I worked for Comic Relief, producing benefits for the homeless at comedy clubs, for which I was paid $200 a week. I did stand-up comedy at the Improv and on the road. And I wrote jokes for other comedians, such as Roseanne Barr, Tom Arnold, Jeff Dunham, George Wallace, Taylor Negron, and Gary Shandling. I was looking for my big break, and it was not coming. Some of my friends were able to get jobs as staff writers on the TV show Roseanne, but I couldn't seem to make that happen. Some of my other friends, such as David Spade and Rob Schneider, and later Adam Sandler, were hired to be writer-performers on Saturday Night Live. But I was never able to get them to hire me. Jim Carrey used to pay me out of his own pocket to write sketches with him for In Living Color, but I could never turn that into an official staff job. I was frustrated and needed to make a move, so I decided to write a spec script, which is basically a sample of writing, in the hopes of getting hired to write for a sitcom. My two favorite television programs at the time were The Simpsons and Chris Elliott's Get a Life. I sat down over the course of a month or two and wrote one spec script for each program. At the time, I thought they came out really well, but when I sent them around town, I didn't get hired by any of the shows I applied to and was only able to get one meeting, which was with David Merkin at Get a Life. But I think I only got that meeting because Gary Shandling forced them to meet with me. The only other feedback I got about my two spec scripts was from Mike Reese and Al Jean, who were running The Simpsons. I was told that they liked my scripts, but they didn't need any writers at the moment. Even though it was a rejection, it did give me some self-esteem. The writers of my favorite show had said something positive. That wouldn't pay my rent, but it was much better than the reaction I had gotten from every other show on television at the time, which was silence. Being unable to find a staff job, I started working on a variety of projects, eventually including the Ben Stiller Show. After the show was canceled, which was just a few months into our run, I got a call from Mike Reese, who told me that he and Al were creating a new show called The Critic, and he wanted to know if I would like to join their staff. I couldn't believe it. He hadn't just been being nice when he said he liked my Simpsons spec. And 22 years later, Mike and Al called me and said they wanted to turn that spec into an actual Simpsons episode. I reread it and was pretty weak, with a few moments of promise. The fact that Mike could see that promise in me when I was still a kid and that he was excited about it was career-changing for me. I certainly didn't deserve to be in that room. I didn't know anything about writing stories. I hadn't earned my way in. But he saw something in me and was very enthusiastic about my writing and my career. When you're young, you're so thrilled to get a job that you don't think much about what an incredibly giving gesture it is for someone to champion you and open that door for you. When I was sitting in that writer's room of The Critic, I was aware that I was sharing that space with some of the best comedy writers in the world. I was in awe on a daily basis. Most of all, I was in awe of Mike, who was endlessly funny and kind. Always in a great mood, he'd pitch line after line and was so funny that it made me scared to pitch at all. But I forced myself to and got an amazing comedy education from Mike, Al, and James Brooks. I have read and watched everything Mike has created, and he is an inspiration as a brilliant comic mind and as a genuinely fantastic person who has done nothing but make the earth a happier place to live. God bless Mike Reese. Judd Apatow. Opening credits. As good a place as any to start. Since season 1, January 1990, each Simpsons episode begins with a joke that is missed by tens of millions of fans in hundreds of millions of viewings. When the Simpsons title card emerges from the clouds, you see the first half of the family's names. The Simps. So what? Well, Simps is short for simpletons. Stupid people like the ones you're about to see on the show. If you never caught this, don't feel bad. Most of our current staff didn't know it either. Other jokes you may have missed in life. Toy Story is a pun on Toy Store. The comedy Legally Blonde is a play on that hilarious term, Legally Blind. And there's a 31 hidden in the BR logo of Baskin-Robbins, referring to their 31 flavor slogan. You've already learned four things, and this is just the start of the audiobook. At The Simpsons, we put as many jokes in our opening credits as some sitcoms put into an entire episode, or all 8 seasons of Home Improvement. Our credits always open with a new chalkboard gag where Bart writes a phrase repeatedly on the school blackboard, such as, "Nerve gas is not a toy." And they always close with our couch gag where the Simpsons pile onto the sofa and something surprising happens. For example, the couch eats them. When the show went to high def in 2009, we added more gags. A flyby. Some Simpsons character zooms by past the title in a weird contraption. And a video billboard. Lisa's sax solo in the theme also changes from week to week. Lately, it hasn't even been a sax. We've also had her play the harp and theremin. The whole idea for ever-changing credits came from an unlikely source, the 1950s Mickey Mouse Club. Its opening credits always ended with Donald Duck hitting a gong and something catastrophic happening. The gong would explode, or Donald would vibrate uncontrollably. There were many variations, but they all ended with a duck getting maimed. Our first chalkboard gag was simple and self-referential. I will not waste chalk. Great joke. But it went downhill fast from there. 2 episodes later, the phrase became, I will not burp in class. While there have been plenty of good ones, like beans are neither fruit nor musical, these gags are very hard to write because anything longer than 10 words goes by too fast to read. Furthermore, when we drop them from the opening credits, which we do more and more, nobody complains. In fact, 16 years ago, we already had Bart writing on the chalkboard, "Nobody reads these anymore." The couch gags are a lot more fun, but a lot more work. We used to repeat every joke once a year, doing 11 couch gags for our 22-episode season. But we quickly learned that if people saw an old couch gag, they thought the whole show was a repeat and tuned out. Now, virtually every episode gets its own couch gag. Generally, our credit jokes are written by the end of the day. If it looks like work might wrap early, say 5:30 p.m., and there's a chance the writers might get home to a hot dinner and non-sleeping children, the boss will tell us to come up with couch gags and chalkboards. Our couch gags have parodied other shows' opening credits, The Big Bang Theory, Game of Thrones, and Breaking Bad. One time, The Simpsons were crushed by the giant foot from the opening credits of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Showrunner David Merkin made sure we use the exact foot Python used. It's from The Allegory of Venus and Cupid by Agnolo Bronzino. A few couch jokes are mini-epics. In just 70 seconds, we recapped all of human history, starting with an amoeba that evolves into an ape, then a caveman, then devolves slightly to Homer Simpson. We condensed the Lord of the Rings trilogy to a minute 39. Sometimes we don't even have to do the work, because guest artists do it for us. This has given us a chance to work with animators we admire, like Bill Plimpton, Ren and Stimpy's John Chris Felucci, Don Hertzfeldt, and the teams from Robot Chicken and Rick and Morty. Guillermo del Toro did a 3-minute spectacular that referenced every horror movie ever made, and it's simply amazing. And then there was the notoriously reclusive artist Banksy. Al Jean approached him, her, it, them, through the producer of the Banksy documentary, Exit Through the Gift Shop. Banksy did a hilariously Orwellian depiction of the Korean animation house where our show is made. In the sequence, Simpsons DVDs are pierced on the horn of a starving unicorn to make the center hole. then packed into boxes sealed with a dead dolphin's tongue. Live white squirrels are fed into a shredder to make stuffing for Bart dolls, then loaded into a cart pulled by a sickly panda. We loved it. Our Korean animators did not. By the way, I was the first Simpsons writer to visit our animation house in Seoul. The workers, mostly women, have nicer, sunnier offices than our writers do, and most of them were watching Korean soap operas on their cell phones as they did their jobs. My all-time favorite couch gag was the one that aired the night our show beat the Flintstones as the longest-running primetime animated show in history. The Simpsons run into the living room where they find the Flintstones already sitting on the couch. That show's producers, Hanna-Barbera, asked that the Flintstones be paid as guest cast, and they were. Fred, Wilma, and Pebbles split $400. Burning questions. Throughout the book, I'll be answering questions most asked by Simpsons fans. Let's start with the big one. Where is Springfield? The name Springfield was chosen by creator Matt Groening for its generic blandness. It was the name of the hometown in the generically bland 1950 sitcom Father Knows Best, and is one of the most commonplace names in America. Only Riverside and Five Points beat it. There are 48 Springfields in 43 U.S. states, which means there are 5 states that have 2 Springfields. Great imagination, folks. But Matt Groening's version of Springfield wasn't intended to be a guessing game. Like most things on The Simpsons, we didn't plan it. And by this point, we've put in enough clues as to where it might be that it can't possibly be anywhere. Let's recap what we know. Springfield has an ocean on its east side and its west side. We once said that East Springfield is 3 times the size of Texas. And in one episode, we see Homer shoveling snow in the morning and lying in a hammock sipping lemonade that afternoon. This raises the question, what planet is Springfield on? The Emmy-winning episode Behind the Laughter ends by calling the Simpsons a family from northern Kentucky. There's your answer. Except that in the closed captioning, we said that they're from Missouri. In the rerun, we changed it to Illinois, and it's referred to as a small island on the DVD. In the Simpsons movie, Ned Flanders said that Springfield State is bordered by Ohio, Nevada, Maine, and Kentucky. There was even a contest to coincide with the release of the movie that invited different Springfields in the United States to make a video explaining why they're the one the Simpsons live in. 13 cities entered, competing for the honor of being America's fattest, dumbest, most polluted town. Springfield, Massachusetts' film featured a guest appearance by Senator Ted Kennedy. He invited his sound-alike character Mayor Quimby to come visit. This was a big concession by Kennedy, since I've heard that he hated the character. And yet, despite all this effort, Massachusetts lost. The winner was Springfield, Vermont. Comedian Henriette Mantel is from Springfield, Vermont, and she told me it's nothing like the town on the show. I like the answer given by John Swartzwelder, the quirky writer of 59 quirky Simpsons episodes. He said, Springfield is in Hawaii. But a few years ago, Matt Groening said the show was set in a town near where he grew up, Springfield, Oregon. What is he now? Act 1. I hope this audiobook feels like a Simpsons episode. Fast-paced, full of quick scenes, and stuffed with hundreds of jokes, some of them funny. I've even structured it like a Simpsons script, which has 4 acts. Setup, complication, resolution, and coda. Now, Aristotle said all drama has 3 acts, and classic films usually employ a 3-act structure. We have 4, which means we're 1 act better than Aristotle. Also, with 4 acts, you can sell more commercials. The Simpsons has a structure like no other show that preceded it. The first act of every episode kicks off with a string of scenes that have nothing to do with the plot of the show. It may be a visit to a water park, a trip to the stamp museum, a visit to an indoor water park. We're kind of running out of ideas. It is until the end of Act 1 that the story really presents itself, though it's barely connected to what came before. Homer fights with Marge in a movie theater and winds up managing a country western singer. Making funeral arrangements for Grandpa becomes a story about the Simpsons getting a tennis court. Lisa becomes a veterinarian after a visit to a water park. The first act of this book will be like that. There's a point to it all, but you'll never see it coming. Chapter 1. It Begins. I got the Simpsons job the same way I got a wife. I was not the first choice, but I was available. I was working at It's Gary Shandling's show, the second lowest rated show on TV. The lowest rated was The Tracy Ullman Show, which featured short cartoons about these ugly little yellow people. The Shandling Show was going on summer break, and showrunner Alan Zweibel was launching a new show called The Boys, a sitcom set at the Friars Club. Man, I wanted that job, where I would have been writing jokes for Norm Crosby and Norman Fell, two of my favorite Normans. But Zweibel opted to hire my old friends Max Pross and Tom Gammel, so my writing partner, Al Jean, and I had to settle for the job they turned down, The Simpsons. Nobody wanted to work on The Simpsons. There hadn't been a cartoon in primetime since The Flintstones, a generation before. Worse yet, the show would be on the Fox Network, a new enterprise that no one was sure would even last. I took the job, but I didn't tell anyone what I was doing. After 8 years of writing for films, sitcoms, and even Johnny Carson, I was now working on a cartoon. I was 28 years old, and I thought I'd hit rock bottom. Still, I'd been a fan of Matt Groening and executive producer Sam Simon for years. They were having fun creating the show, and it was infectious. It was a summer job, and it felt like summer jobs I'd had in the past, selling housewares, filing death certificates. We knew we wouldn't be doing this forever, so no one took it too seriously. We didn't even have a real office at the time. The studio had so little faith in us, they housed us in a trailer. I assumed that if the show failed, they'd slowly back the trailer up to the Pacific and drown the writers like rats. Al Jean and I quickly churned out 3 of the first 8 episodes of the show. There's No Disgrace Like Home, which ends with the Simpsons electrocuting each other during family therapy. Moaning Lisa, in which a depressed Lisa meets jazz great Bleeding Gums Murphy. And The Telltale Head, where Bart saws the head off the Jebediah Springfield statue. This is also the episode in which Sideshow Bob, Reverend Lovejoy, Krusty the Clown, and Bully's Jimbo Dolphin Kearney first appear. But the whole time I was writing, I groused, I'd rather be doing jokes for Norman Fell. Since so few writers wanted to work on the series, we wound up with a very eclectic writing staff. Except for Al and me, none of them had ever written a sitcom script before. They'd come from the world of sketches, late-night TV, even advertising. One day before the series premiered, I was sitting in the trailer with the other writers. After Matt Groening left the room, I asked the question that was on all of our minds. How long do you think this show will actually last? Every writer had the same answer. 6 weeks. 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 weeks. Only Sam Simon was optimistic. I think it'll last 13 weeks, he said, but don't worry. No one will ever see it. It won't hurt your career. Maybe that's the secret of the show's success. Since we thought no one would be watching, we didn't make the kind of show we saw on TV. We made the kind of show we wanted to see on TV. It was unpredictable. One week we wrote a whodunit, and in another we parodied the French film Manon of the Spring. The only rule was one we made for ourselves. Don't be boring. The scenes were snappy and packed with jokes, in the dialogue, in the foreground, and in the background. When Homer went to a video arcade in episode 6, Al and I filled the place with funny games like Pack Rat, Escape from Grandma's House, and Robert Goulet Destroyer. And if you missed a joke the first time, no problem. Everyone in America was starting to get VCRs so they could tape the show and watch it again. Remember, this was 1988, and the number one TV series was The Cosby Show. It was a great show, but slow. Nothing ever happened on The Cosby Show. A lot happened right after The Cosby Show. It's no joke to say that the fastest-paced, most irreverent comedy on TV around this time was The Golden Girls, a show about three corpses and a mummy. I broke into sitcoms writing a script for The Golden Girls. Now I am one. Dan Castellaneta on The Simpsons Prospects. When I read the first script, I was blown away. I really thought it was well written. I didn't know whether or not the show would be successful, but if we only had 13 episodes, we would at least have a cult following. The scripts were that good. The Simpsons Speak. After a year spent preparing 13 scripts, it was time for a table read. This is when the writers and producers get together in a conference room to hear the actors perform the script for the first time. It's probably the most important part of the process. How do the characters sound and interact? Does the story flow? Do the jokes get laughs from the 50 or 60 people in the room? Our first table read was in early 1989. It was the first time the Simpsons cast was gathered in one place and the first time they acted out a full episode of the show. I recognize Dan Castellaneta, he plays Homer, from the Tracy Ullman show. As for Julie Kavner, Marge, I'd had a crush on her since she played Brenda Morgenstern on Rhoda. I still do. Even though I'd co-written 3 episodes by this point, I had no idea that the children's voices were done by adult women. I'd assume Bart was played by a young boy, not 32-year-old Nancy Cartwright. It was even weirder that Yardley Smith, a grown woman, barely changed her voice to play Lisa Simpson. Oh, that poor girl going through life with that voice, I thought. That poor girl has since earned an Emmy and $65 million with that voice. Hank Azaria hadn't been cast yet. At that time, his character Mo was played by comedian Christopher Collins. When Hank was later hired, he went back and re-recorded all of Mo's lines. Cartoon legend June Foray, she was Rocky the Flying Squirrel, also did a few parts at that first reading, but she sounded too cartoony for our show. A local radio personality played psychiatrist Dr. Marvin Monroe, but he was fired at the end of the reading. We later killed off the character of Marvin Monroe, and the real radio shrink we based him on committed suicide. All in all, kind of a cursed character. Comedy writer Jerry Belson, considered one of the funniest men in the world, was brought in to punch up the script with new jokes. He offered only one, a psychiatric patient we described as nail-biter, not his own, was changed by Jerry to bedwetter, not his own. I didn't realize what a momentous occasion this table reading was because, frankly, it wasn't. The whole thing played a little flat, kind of slow, a few laughs. No one would have guessed from that first table read that we'd be doing 600 more of them. The prospects for The Simpsons weren't great, and they were about to get even bleaker. We almost get canceled before we come on. Fox had to take a giant leap of faith when the network picked up The Simpsons for the first season. With an animated show, a studio can't just do a pilot and then decide later to pick up the rest of the series. It's prohibitively expensive to make only one episode of a cartoon. Animation is also a slow process. There would be a one-year gap between the pilot and the first episode. By that time, half the network executives who'd bought the show would have been fired, forced out of the business, and possibly fugitives from justice. So Fox had to pick up a whole season of The Simpsons and paid something like $13 million for 13 episodes, without seeing one frame of animation. Our first finished full-color episode, the pilot, called Some Enchanted Evening, had just come in from overseas. While our basic creative animation is done in Hollywood, the actual drawing and hand-painting of over 24,000 cells in each episode is done in Korea. South Korea. The nice Korea. The plot of the pilot has the notorious babysitter bandit trying to rob the Simpsons' house while Homer and Marge are having a romantic night away from the kids. When the writers and Fox executives got together and watched it, they thought it was terrible. A total disaster. The script was clumsy, pilots often are, but it was the animation that felt completely wrong. The Simpsons' house was bendy, Homer was wiggly, all of Springfield seemed to be made of rubber. When the screening ended, there was dead silence. The small audience in attendance gaped at the screen like it was the first act of springtime for Hitler. Someone had to break the silence. Finally, writer Wally Wolodarski shouted with ironic glee, "Show it again!" Fox was up in arms. It's possible this would have been the end of The Simpsons. But the next week, a second episode, Bart the Genius, came in, where Bart cheats on an IQ test and ends up getting sent to a school for gifted children. And that episode, thankfully, was just great. It was directed with a sure hand by David Silverman, and the script was by one of our best writers, John Vitti. It reaffirmed everyone's faith in the show. This forced us into switching around the order of how the episodes were to be aired. And so The Simpsons premiered 3 months late with Episode 9, Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire. It was a Christmas special. Bart the Genius would be the first regular episode, and the original pilot became our season finale, giving us time to fix the animation. In December 1989, we had a premiere party for the Christmas show in a bowling alley. It was pretty low rent as premiere parties go, but then Fox wasn't eager to throw more money at our expensive little series. And then at 8 p.m., the show aired. We all stopped bowling to watch it on overhead monitors. And it was funny, touching, smart, and sweet. None of us saw it coming. Soon after, someone from Fox's publicity team came in with a packet of reviews from newspapers across the country. The critics not only loved the show, they recognized it as groundbreaking and a game changer. The next morning, we learned that The Simpsons had debuted to the highest rating in the history of the Fox network. We were a success right out of the gate, and we were all over the moon, except for one man. Sam Simon stood at the back of the bowling alley, flipping through the packet of reviews with a wry smile on his face. At last, he said with a rueful laugh, "They don't mention me once." It's not as petty as it may sound. The Simpsons was the greatest thing Sam had done in an already great career that included Taxi and Cheers. Sam had hired all the Simpsons writers, set the tone of the show, worked out all the stories, and supervised every script. And to his surprise, Matt Groening got all the acclaim. Matt never hogged the credit. Whenever he did an interview, he would mention us all by name. When he went on The Tonight Show, I remember he kept bringing up the other writers, but Jay Leno cut him off. Why? It made for a great story. TV is being changed by an underground cartoonist who's breaking all the rules. Instead of TV's being changed by an underground cartoonist and a veteran TV producer, Sam Simon. And so The Simpsons was launched. The public loved us, the critics loved us, and the creators were beginning to hate each other. Simpsons Mania! Months after our premiere, The Simpsons was not just in the papers every day. It was in every section of the newspaper. News, entertainment, sports, business. Editors realized the cartoon of Bart was more eye-catching than, say, a photo of Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger. And 90% of what I read about The Simpsons was wrong, which made me realize 90% of everything I read in the papers was probably wrong. For example, when blues guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter crash, one newspaper reported that his last act had been to record a song for the upcoming Simpsons Sing the Blues album. In truth, Mr. Vaughan's last act was to say something like, "Fuck the Simpsons, I'm not recording a song for their stupid album." In 1990, Matt Groening wound up on a list of one of the 10 most admired men in America, while Sam Simon was the answer to a trivia question on a Simpsons bubblegum card. The world kept forcing all the credit on Matt, and it made Sam miserable. He could be a wraith in the office, stomping around like Salieri and Amadeus. Sam was still running the show and turning out classic scripts. He could be great fun to be around. But when Matt came into the room, Sam would glower at him and make nasty asides till Matt walked out. I sympathized with Sam, but I felt bad for Matt too. Here was the crowning achievement of his life, and he was unwelcome in his own office. One day I went to Matt privately and told him, "Not everybody hates you." When Matt told Sam a writer had said that, Sam got furious. "You're lying! Who was it?" I never fessed up, and I never will. Oh crap, I just did. Amazingly, Sam turned his bitterness into a great episode. He pitched a story where Homer, like Sam, creates something truly extraordinary, and Mo gets all the credit for it. Homer becomes twisted with rage and destroys them both. The show is called Flaming Moe's and is considered one of the best Simpsons episodes ever. This Cold War went all the way through the first two seasons. By the end, Sam and Matt were not talking, casting a pall over what should have been happy, glorious years. So how was it resolved? They told Sam to stop running the show and put two saps in charge, me and Al Jean. Up until that point, the biggest thing I'd ever run was a dishwasher. Al Jean on taking over The Simpsons. Mike and I were so intimidated because we knew this was a great show, a classic. We had left ALF after season 2, and by season 4 it was already off the air. So I was really scared that if The Simpsons was canceled while we were running it, we'd be blamed for ruining this incredible thing. And there was a history of shows that appeal mostly to kid audiences, like Mork and Mindy or ALF, that shoot up and then shoot back down very quickly. They became evanescent, so Mike and I worked on The Simpsons nonstop to make sure that didn't happen to us. Who's the genius? Decades after the Matt and Sam conflicts, fans still ask, who's the one genius responsible for The Simpsons? It's a show with 20 writers, dozens of animators, 47 producers, and 10 regular or semi-regular voice actors, but everyone wants to find the one guy responsible. It's understandable. Everybody loves a hero story. For years, the title went to Matt Groening. He did, after all, create The Little Bastards. Then the honor shifted to Sam Simon, and then to writer George Meyer after he was written up in The New Yorker, that gut-bustingly funny magazine. Strangely, no one has ever given the credit to me, including me. Who's the genius? My answer to the question narrows it down to three people. Actually, four. Nope, five. Make that 13. Matt Groening definitely created The Simpsons, and the story of how he did it is truly unbelievable. Matt was a Los Angeles underground cartoonist when he was called in for a meeting at the Tracy Ullman Show. The series had one-minute animated bumpers, as well as live novelty acts, but no one was particularly enamored with them. Matt was told this was a get-acquainted meeting. He wasn't expected to pitch anything. But shortly before the meeting, someone told him, "We're very excited to hear about your new project." Matt didn't have one. And so, 5 minutes before the meeting, he sketched out The Simpsons family. It took him 5 minutes to create one of the most honored shows in TV history. Just imagine if he'd spent half an hour. How did he come up with it so fast? For starters, he named the characters after his family. His parents, Homer and Marge. His sisters, Lisa and Maggie. He claims Bart is just an anagram of brat, but I think the name may have been inspired by his brother Mark. The Simpsons shorts are primitive. So primitive, in fact, that they've never been released on DVD. So primitive that even Fox has never tried to make a buck on them. But they quickly evolve, thanks to Matt's graphic genius. He once told me, the key to The Simpsons is that each character is recognizable in silhouette. It's an amazing insight, one I never heard from any other cartoonist. In the earliest days of the show, when we'd be screening rough animation, he'd stop tape every few seconds. "I hate those lines around Bart's eyes. That napkin holder is too small." I thought he was nuts. But watching those old shows now, I see that he was creating the precise look of the show as he went along. Also, the napkin holder was too small. When the call came to turn the shorts into a half-hour series, Matt was paired with Sam Simon. Sam was a TV prodigy, having run the show Taxi at age 23, before moving on to Cheers and It's Gary Shandling's show. Sam supervised the writing of The Simpsons' first two seasons and developed the show's signature mix of highbrow and low, all moving at warp speed. So if Matt is Thomas Edison inventing the light bulb, Sam is George Westinghouse, building the factory to crank the bulbs out. Then there's James L. Brooks. I call him Jim. You don't get to. Jim gave the character soul and pitched the long, heartfelt monologues that gave The Simpsons unexpected depth. To continue the metaphor, Jim Brooks gave the light bulb heart. All right, let's drop the metaphor. There's a simple mnemonic to remember it all. Matt did the art, Sam made it smart, Jim gave it heart. Easy, but wrong, because Matt and Jim also pitched great jokes and stories, and Sam was no slouch at art. He was a college cartoonist who went on to design Mr. Burns and Bleeding Gums Murphy. Speaking of art, let's not forget David Silverman, the animation supervisor of the show for decades. He first pitched the idea to Jim of turning the one-minute Simpsons shorts into a half-hour show. David had to reinvent how to produce a weekly animated series. It had been 20 years since The Flintstones was in primetime, and no one remembered how it was done. Silverman refined the style of the show and set a high standard for the animation. Even as a kid watching The Flintstones, I thought, they keep running past the same goddamn palm tree. David had brilliant animators working for him, including future Oscar winners Brad Bird, director of Ratatouille and The Incredibles, and Rich Moore, who did Zootopia. And we can't ignore Al Jean, who has had the soul-crushing job of showrunner on The Simpsons for 20 of its 30 seasons. Nor can you forget our six main cast members, Dan Castellaneta, Julie Kavner, Nancy Cartwright, Yardley Smith, Hank Azaria, and Harry Shearer, who created the voices not only of The Simpsons family, but the other 200 residents of Springfield as well. That's the answer. Those 13 men and women are the one guy who is most responsible for The Simpsons. That's all, folks. In 1993, midway through season 4, Sam Simon was asked to leave the show he helped create. In 2015, he passed away at the young age of 59. He retained his executive producer credit and salary on The Simpsons through the end of his life, although he hadn't worked on the show or even set foot in the office for more than two decades. As for Matt, Futurama later proved that even without Sam's help, he could create a smart, visionary show. In the end, Sam got over his anger, saying, "I've gone from getting too little credit for The Simpsons to too much." Matt said something similar to LA Weekly in 2007. He said, "I'm one of those people who gets more credit than I deserve." There you have it, the one dark secret of our show, the lone bruise on The Simpsons banana. That's all the gossip I've got. Okay, there's a little bit more ugliness in Chapter 12 during the Simpsons critic crossover. Maybe that's the key to the show's longevity. There's no drama at our comedy show. The Simpsons keeps rolling along because everybody gets along. The cast, the animators, and the writers all respect each other. There are still plenty of stories and secrets to tell about the show, but if you want dirt, dig a hole. Now let's step back a little to how I got here. Chapter 2, A Brief History of Me. I was recently reading about myself on IMDb because, well, who else would? In a discussion thread entitled, "Mike Reese Simpsons DVD Commentaries," someone posted, "This guy sounds like he's smiling all the time." That made me smile. But the next post read, "Yeah, it really gets on your nerves." I stopped smiling. But screw that guy! If I do smile a lot, it's because I have the funnest job in the world. And because I have a beautiful wife who laughs at all my jokes. And because I think funnest is a word. As a child, I spent my first 3 years sitting in my playpen, never saying a word, just grinning like an idiot. My mother finally took me to a doctor who told her, "The boy's not brain damaged, he's just a little slow." Let's chalk it up to the fact that I found life amusing even at that age. I believe I was making up jokes for other babies like, "My daddy breastfeeded me." Hey, that's pretty good. But to best understand my upbringing, you have to start with a joke about jokes. A convict stands up in a prison mess hall and yells, "73!" All the other inmates laugh. A new prisoner asks the guard, "What's going on?" The guard explains that the prison has one joke book and all the prisoners have memorized it. So instead of telling the joke, they just say the number of it. So the new prisoner stands up and yells, "48!" He gets no response and asks the guard why. The guard says to him, "Some guys know how to tell them, some guys don't." My childhood was like this prison. I grew up in a house full of funny people who all loved jokes. We studied the 400-page Joey Adams joke dictionary the way creepy families studied the Bible. In fact, none of us had to tell a whole joke. We just mention a joke fragment like elephant ear sandwich, and everyone would laugh. Here's the elephant ear sandwich joke. A deli has a sign outside that said, "We make any kind of sandwich." So a wise guy says, "All right, I'd like an elephant ear sandwich." The waiter goes into the kitchen and comes back a minute later and says, "Sorry, we can't do it. The boss won't kill a whole elephant for one sandwich." I grew up in suburban Connecticut, the middle child of five kids. I have a brother who dabbled in stand-up comedy and a sister who wrote a joke book for speech therapists entitled, "How Many Speech Language Pathologists Does It Take to Change an Audiologist?" It got 5 stars on Amazon. I was a pretty funny kid, too. One day my mother heard that our handsome neighbor was marrying a hunchback. She said, "Why would he do that?" And I said, "For good luck." My father, normally a gentleman, smacked me in the head. When I turned 10, I offered my Hungarian grandmother a slice of my birthday cake. She said in her Yoda-like old Jewish lady syntax, "I only want next year you should give me a piece." I replied, "It'll be stale by then." My father smacked me again. I began to think a joke was not truly good unless someone got hit for telling it. My dad, a physician, a historian, a Phi Beta Kappa scholar, had a little bit of Homer Simpson in him. All dads do. You know, that mixture of anger, love, frustration, and more anger. Matt somehow found the character in his own father, Homer Groening, a documentary filmmaker who surfed and ironically had a full head of hair. Sam Simon developed the character drawing on his father, a man who seems to have little in common with Homer. He was a one-legged Jewish millionaire from Beverly Hills. My father's mother may have been the funniest one in the family. I once asked her after reading a Dixie Cup riddle, "What's worse than finding a worm in an apple?" The cup's answer was, "Finding half a worm in an apple." My Grandma Rosie's answer, "Having someone shove an umbrella up your tuchus and then opening it." This was a better answer, and she came up with it so fast I thought it must have happened to her. Maybe it was the Cossacks, maybe it was Grandpa. My other grandmother summed up our family best. Grandma Mickey was a South Carolina Jew, which is sort of like being a Baptist. After a family dinner one night, she said, "Y'all make so many jokes." Then after a beat, she added, "Of course, none of them are worth a damn." Bristol, Connecticut was a factory town that didn't make things. We made the things that went into other things. Brass, springs, and ball bearings. Ask anyone from Bristol what it's like, and they'll say, "It's like the town from The Deer Hunter." I was never sure whether they meant Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, or Saigon. But to me, Bristol represented Springfield. I've used so much of what I saw growing up as inspiration for The Simpsons. One of the very first scenes in the first episode of the show has Homer losing a game of Scrabble to his son and then throwing the whole game into the fireplace. My friend's father did that. His name was Mr. Burns, by the way, Larry Burns. Years later, we did an episode where Monty Burns' illegitimate son shows up. He was gloriously voiced by Rodney Dangerfield. By coincidence, the episode writer Ian Maxtone Graham named the character Larry Burns. By an even greater coincidence, the artist designed a character that looked exactly like my friend's father. I told the real Larry Burns that we had named and designed the character just like him. He seemed totally unimpressed. Nobody cared about showbiz in Bristol. But after he died, I found out that my Larry Burns had bought up every Larry Burns Simpsons collectible figure in America. Maybe he was building a clone army. Like many comedy writers, I was inspired at a young age by the Dick Van Dyke Show. But I didn't want to be Dick, handsome TV head writer, married to perky Mary Tyler Moore. I wanted to be Maury Amsterdam, the funny little guy on the show with the big blonde wife who cracked a lot of jokes at the office but didn't do much work. I have achieved all my childhood goals. I love movies too, and I was obsessed with the Marx Brothers. I was fascinated by one of their writers, Al Boasberg, the great script doctor. It was said that Boasberg couldn't write a great screenplay, but he was a genius at punching up other people's work. Somehow I knew that's what I was destined to do, not to be a writer, but to be a rewriter. And when my parents' friends ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I tell them a script doctor. "Oh, isn't that cute," they say. "He wants to be a doctor like his daddy." "Not a doctor, you country fried idiots. A script doctor," I'd mutter. My writing career began in third grade. My teacher, Miss Borwerk, inspired the first poem I ever wrote. I have a teacher named Miss Borwerk. Every day she gives me more work. All right, it's not Stephen Sondheim, but I was 8, for Christ's sake. Whenever I came home from school, my mother would ask me what had happened in class that day. I'd say, "Nothing." And my mom said, "Nothing didn't happen in school today. Tomorrow when you come home, you better have something to tell me." Well, the next day, nothing happened in school. When my mom asked me about my day, I panicked. In desperation, I said, "Today a dog walked into class and Miss Borwerk threw it out the window." This seemed to satisfy her. So the next day when nothing happened in school, I told her, "Today Miss Borwerk shot at the kids with paintballs." And the next day, Miss Borwerk took off her underwear in front of the class. What I didn't realize is my mom believed these stories. She called the principal and said, "You have a teacher there named Miss Borwerk and she's a lunatic." When the principal reprimanded Miss Borwerk for taking off her underwear in class, Miss Borwerk protested, "I don't wear underwear." In turn, Miss Borwerk yelled at the principal yelled at my mother, and my mother should have yelled at me. Instead, she bought me a pencil box and a pad of paper and told me, "From now on, if you're going to make up stories, write them down." And I've been making up stories ever since, including that whole story about Miss Borwerk. It never happened. Psych! The next three teacher stories are absolutely true, but God, I wish they weren't. I had a teacher who liked my writing and told me to follow my dreams. The next year, he was arrested by the vice squad for following his dreams. Another teacher told me, "Be what you always wanted to be." I ran into him 6 years later in a Boston salad bar. He was my bus boy. Now, maybe this is what he always wanted to be, but it raised an interesting philosophical question. How much do you tip the man who changed your life? Answer, 17%. Finally, there was Mrs. DeFeo, my faculty advisor, who would hack my high school newspaper articles to pieces and change all my punchlines. This was excellent training for a career in television. I once wrote a parody of our Student of the Month column. That month's winner was a clearly psychotic kid who suggested we change the school colors to black and darker black. Mrs. DeFeo changed the line to black and blue. She said, "I can't believe you missed the obvious joke." "That's why I didn't do it," I said. "It's the obvious joke." And she said, "You'll never get a job writing for Cracked Magazine with that attitude." Every night I'd pray to God that he'd punish Mrs. DeFeo for her crimes against comedy. A year later, she won $1 million in the Connecticut lottery. God always listens to my prayers, then does the exact opposite. This was a rough and tumble public high school, and I was the only Jewish kid out of 1,600 students. And yet still my mother said, "I only want you to date Jewish girls." I said, "Well, Mom, it looks like it's going to have to be you." So I dated my mom for a few months. We got along fine, but her kids hated me. In 1990, when I won my first Emmy for The Simpsons, I had my wife take a picture, and I sent it to the hometown newspaper. 3 days later, that photo of me appeared on the front page of the local paper. It's me in a tuxedo. I'm holding the Emmy. And the caption read, "Local man claims to win award." On to Harvard. If a giant sinkhole opened up and swallowed Harvard University, I'd think, poor sinkhole. I spent 4 years at Harvard, and I hated the place. I'm not alone. In a 2006 poll, the Boston Globe ranked schools in terms of fun and social life. Harvard came in fifth, from the bottom. Amazing. I couldn't imagine four schools less fun than Harvard, but then I saw the list. The four schools ranked below us were Guantanamo Tech, Chernobyl Community College, the University of California at Aleppo, and Cornell. At Harvard, the professors were dispassionate and their classes were esoteric, although they did teach me the words dispassionate and esoteric. In 4 years there, I learned three things: how to open a champagne bottle, how to make a bong out of an apple, and that mayonnaise is delicious. We didn't have this stuff in my house growing up. I went to college knowing Latin and calculus. After 4 years, I'd forgotten them both. I blame the apple bong for that. I tried to have fun at Harvard. In my freshman year, I did stand-up in the school talent show. After the performance, the judge said to me, "You're pretty funny." So I married her. That's the last time I ever did stand-up. There was only one other comedian in the talent show, a guy named Paul, and he bombed terribly. Paul's joke was, "Coming up next, the survivors of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre will form a human pyramid." Audience, boo! After the show, I told him, "Paul, maybe comedy's not your thing." He took my advice, went into drama, and created the hit medical show House. Paul is now worth $1 zillion. Me? I still steal Splendas from KFC. In short, there are just two things I took from Harvard that I treasure to this day: my beautiful wife Denise and a large pile of library books. They're both stacked in the bedroom. Audience, boo! The Harvard Lampoon. Why did I even go to Harvard? I only knew two facts about the place before enrolling. Number one, Thurston Howell III, the clueless millionaire from Gilligan's Island, went there. My freshman roommate, by the way, was Thurston Howell IV. And number two, Harvard had a humor magazine, the Harvard Lampoon, and I wanted to be part of it. Back in the 1970s, the Lampoon was not known as an incubator for comedy writers. In fact, for its first century of existence, it produced only four famous graduates: Robert Benchley, George Plimpton, John Updike, and Fred Gwynne, the guy who played Herman Munster. Really? In comedy terms, that list of famous alumni consists of a funny guy, a wry guy, a serious guy, and Frankenstein. The legacy of the Lampoon changed when a member named Jim Downey got hired on the first season of Saturday Night Live, and he stayed there for the next four decades. Jim Downey opened the door to two more Lampoon friends, who let in some more friends, and by the end of the millennium, there were dozens of Lampooners in movie and TV comedy. Jim Downey was like a funny patient zero. There's so many of us working in Hollywood that we're called the Lampoon Mafia, which I think is kind of an insult to the Mafia. At least they have a code of honor. At the 2016 Emmys, four of the six nominated comedy series were run by Lampoon alums: Veep, Silicon Valley, Master of None, and The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. The last two series were created by Lampooners as well. In the Best Comedy Script category, four of the five nominees, including the winner, were written by our graduates. Lampoon people are everywhere, working on, sometimes running, every late-night show: Fallon, Kimmel, Corden, Colbert, The Daily Show, and obviously Conan. They've made up 30% or more of the writers of the seminal comedies of the recent past: Seinfeld, SNL, Letterman, and The Office. And in animation, you'll find them working for Bob's Burgers, Futurama, Family Guy, and of course, The Simpsons. Our original writing staff, hired by Stanford grad Sam Simon, was half Lampooners. Since then, about 40 more Harvard grads have worked on the show, including 11 Lampoon presidents. But how does a magazine founded in the 19th century prepare writers for a career in TV? Because by pure accident of history, the competition to get on the Lampoon operates exactly like the TV business. Students competing, called compers, are expected to turn in six humorous articles in 8 weeks, which teaches you to hit deadlines and to be prolific, two fundamental skills in television. Like in TV, the competition is brutal. Every year about 100 writers try out, and only 7 get chosen. And finally, just like in TV, the process is completely unfair. Very few compers get elected their first time. I had to go through the process twice. Dave Mandel, the brilliant showrunner who year after year takes Veep to an Outstanding Comedy Series Emmy, went through it 5 times. Comedy legend Al Franken was turned down by the magazine, which shows it's easier to get elected to, and subsequently booted out of, the U.S. Senate than to get on the Harvard Lampoon. To join the magazine, you need to be self-confident, dedicated, and a little bit delusional, just like a TV writer. Once you get on the staff, whether it's the Lampoon or a sitcom, you're doing the same thing. Sitting on your ass in a room full of funny people, eating crap food. In both cases, you shoot the breeze all day and long into the night, making jokes and mastering the skill of fast, funny banter. The one paradox is that while the Lampooners write great TV, their magazine sucks. I've never understood why, but the Harvard Lampoon is bad today, it was bad when I was president, and it was bad when Robert Benchley ran it. For the half-century before him, it was bad and racist. You can read all about it in my next book, 50 Years of Laughter, 140 Years of the Harvard Lampoon. Conan O'Brien's Harvard Lampoon Dinner. Conan writes, Mike and Al showed up at the Lampoon and we had a big dinner for them. It was not even my idea, but I think the chef thought it would be really funny that since I was the president of the Lampoon, they would just serve potatoes for dinner. That's all there was, potatoes. And I remember Al Jean and Mike Reese being really pissed because they had legitimately come here for a meal. We treated the meal as a funny conceptual thing, and they were like, where's my fucking lobster? We were like, well, no, this is the comedy, you see? And they were like, no, we're adults, and this is supposed to be a meal, and we're hungry. So they didn't forgive me for that for a while. For years afterward, Mike Reese was mad about that potato dinner. I think he got back at me, though, because I went to his apartment in New York a few years ago, and he served me some manischewitz out of a box that I think had been sitting in the sun since the Ford administration. So he got me back. Author's note. I thought that was good wine. Chapter 3. Funny for Money. It was April of my senior year, and I had no post-graduation plans or career prospects. I thought because I went to Harvard, God would provide. And they did. I'm a polytheist. My break came when I got a call from Ted Mann, an editor at National Lampoon. In its heyday, National Lampoon magazine was the sole outlet for irreverent adult humor in America. It was like The Onion, The Daily Show, and SNL all rolled into one. Ted said, we've been reading your articles in the Harvard Lampoon, and we'd like to hire you. I said, you read the Harvard Lampoon? And he said, we've been reading it for years. We just never saw anything good before. They hired my roommate and writing partner, Al Jean, as well. So a month after graduation, we moved to New York City, sharing a chic industrial loft in Soho over a hat factory. At National Lampoon, we made our own schedule, wrote what we wanted, and earned a cool $22,500 a year. That may not sound like much now, but back in 1981, it was still terrible. Al and I distinguished ourselves early on with an article called How to Write Dirty by Justice Thurgood Marshall. This may seem like a non sequitur, but it was rooted in fact. Back in the 80s, the Supreme Court was forced to screen a lot of pornography in judging First Amendment cases. Some of the justices looked away from the porn, some boycotted the screenings altogether. Thurgood Marshall brought popcorn. So we wrote the silly, raunchy article giving Thurgood way too many Supreme Court puns. Hey, Felix Frankfurter, suck my wiener. And I told Harry Blackman, I'm the real Harry Blackman around these parts. We published it thinking, with good reason, Thurgood would never see it. but if he did see it, I thought maybe he would kind of like it. 10 years later, when Thurgood Marshall died, his obituary was the top story in the Los Angeles Times. The first paragraph